The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings.
Our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world. And yet, I ask you, is not an alien force already among us?
Exopolitics, paranormal phenomena, and deep analysis of current world events from somewhere in the desert between Area 51 and Roswell, blasting across the planet, the Manticore Network proudly presents Veritas, because the truth will set you free.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
They were too fast to be an airplane.
I think it's time to open the books on the question of government investigations of UFOs. We ought to do it really because it's right. We ought to do it because the American people, quite frankly, can handle the truth. And we ought to do it because it's the law.
Be skeptical. Do be as skeptical as you want, but by all, don't close your mind.
Greetings to everyone around the world, and a warm welcome to another edition of the Veritas Show, where we bring a disclosure, one guest at a time. I'm your host, Mal Fabregas, and I sincerely thank you for joining me once again. And if this is your first time, make yourself at home. First, I want to welcome and thank our new and existing Veritas members. You are keeping Veritas alive. Tonight's special guest is futurist Neil Freer, author of many books, including his latest, Sapiens Rising, The View from 2100. Neil will be with us shortly. Next week's special guest is Stan Romanek. If you haven't heard of Stan Romanek's story, it is riveting and very emotional. Stan is a special experiencer who continues to have these episodes. Make sure to tune in. Some of you have asked when the Veritas shirt will be available. I'm working with a few vendors and should have something online in the new Veritas shop very soon. Also, a number of people have given me the idea of creating a gift certificate program for the upcoming holidays. It's nice to hear some of the comments as, quote, "I don't want to give a gift that won't be put to good use," unquote. Well, I'm happy to say in the next few days, I will have a gift certificate system where you can give the gift of truth to anyone. You'll be able to buy 3, 6 months, or 1 year. I will set up a new account for the person of your choosing. Also, some of you have asked how to join for a full year. You can certainly do that, and you don't have to worry about it until the next year. Just go to veritasshow.com, click on subscribe, and you will see the instructions there. If you subscribe with a quarterly recurring payment, you are actually paying $5.32 per month, which gives you access to all our 48 shows to date, all available for download, and all the upcoming ones too. Access to the Manticore Forum and a modern chat system where you can interact with me and some of the guests of the show. To become a member, again, simply go to our website, veritasshow.com, and click on subscribe. Incidentally, speaking of our chat system, if you are listening to the show prior to 8 p.m. Pacific time on Friday, November the 6th, it is our first show of the month. Therefore, I will be in the chat room from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific. So head on over to our website again, veritasshow.com, and click on the chat link. I want to discuss any subject, but I also want your feedback and ideas for 2010. Bring your microphone. This is you and I talking. And for those in other parts of the world, we'll try to save the chat for you. And remember, my interaction with you does not end with the show. It only begins. You can still interact with me and hundreds of other members around the world by joining the Manticore Forum. I will be posting my very first video interview at the forum. The interview was recorded at the CSETI conference with Paula Harris. If you need to get in touch with me, send me an email at mail, that's M-E-L, at veritasshow.com, or click on the contact link of our website. Someone contacted me with an idea. As you know, our first segment is syndicated by K-Rock's Zero Point Radio, the Black Vault Radio Network, and the Paranormal Radio Network. However, I have heard of Shoutcast, which apparently has a huge reach. This is another platform to reach a lot of new listeners. I will let you know once that is established. A mysterious virus hits Ukraine. 9 regions, especially in western Ukraine, have been put under quarantine. Schools and cinema have been banned for 3 weeks as part of a crackdown by the authorities. Reports from people, however, indicate there is no sign of a pandemic, fueling fears that the pandemic emergency is being hyped by the media and used as a pretext for military rule by Ukraine's government, hit by corruption scandals and protests over the sinking standard of living. Now, let's not forget the swine flu pandemic. Yes, you heard right, ladies and gentlemen. Let's call it what it is, a plandemic. It is still being hyped by the media. Incidentally, we closed our Veritas poll last Sunday. The question was, will you get vaccinated for the swine flu? 96% said no, and 4% said yes. And about Ukraine, apparently the media there is talking about a new strain, A/N1N1. Remember, the swine flu strain is H1N1. However, the only snippets I'm getting from the mainstream media in the United States hardly mentions it. And at best, they just say the swine flu is becoming deadly in Ukraine, when it's not even the same strain. Apparently, they want to make people more scared in this part of the world. I also heard that the incumbent president, Yushchenko, has the lowest ratings of his tenure and is creating this plandemic. Public events and schools, as I said, have been closed for 2 to 3 weeks. Martial law is possible. Bear in mind that with very low ratings, the rival with close ties to Russia has a possibility of winning. By President Yushchenko declaring martial law, he would also be postponing the elections. Very interesting, isn't it? Now, last week, while I was sharing with you my experience at the CSETI conference, I left out an important detail. During Dr. Greer's last presentation, he shared with us that during one of his appearances on Coast to Coast AM, this one on October 2004, was called Government Cover-Ups. He was talking about MJ-12 and the fact that Vice President at the time, Dick Cheney, was a member, or is a member. During a commercial break, a voice came on. It was not George Norrie or any other member of the Coast to Coast staff. The voice said, quote, "Dr. Greer, change the direction of this interview or we will dump the show live," unquote. I thought that story was amazing. I needed to confirm this, so I went to my Coast to Coast AM archive, since I'm a subscriber of their StreamLink service, and found that show. Indeed, I found the part in question. It goes to show you that the NSA holds the switch and can cut the satellite feed at any time. I wanted to share with you that portion, but due to copyright issues, I can only mention it to you. The show with Dr. Greer aired on Thursday, October the 28th, 2004. As one of our listeners said last week, Dr. Greer knows how to draw heat. Does this give you an idea of why Veritas is so important? We are uncensored, unscripted, and uncut. And I have an important announcement to make. I'm proud to announce that the Veritas show has been assigned its own sub-forum at one of the best and most open-minded forums in the world, Open Minds Forum. I want to thank Bren, Stephen, and all the good people from Open Minds Forum for welcoming Veritas and giving it a bit of your cyber real estate there. I look forward to interacting with all of the members. And I doubt you don't know Open Minds Forum, but if you don't, go to openmindsforum.com and join their community. It is indeed a very special place. And now, get ready to spend a night with someone who has spent a lot of time with Zachariah Sitchin and studies the future, a post-disclosure world, immortality, a new human planetary society, an open source government, 2012, the Anunnaki, Nibiru, and much more. By listening to this show, you're leaving the Matrix. Listen at your own peril. This is Mel Fabregas, and you're listening to The Veritas Show. Don't go anywhere. Most of the great music you hear right here on The Veritas Show is supplied by the independent artists from Jamendo.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to our homepage, veritasshow.com, click on the guest, look up the song, and download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases right there at Jamendo.com.
This is Zachariah Sitchin, and you are listening to a wonderful radio interview conducted by Mel.
Neil Freer is a researcher, writer, lecturer, philosopher, futurist, futant, and poet, living in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Neil holds a bachelor's degree in English and a graduate work in philosophy and psychology at the New School for Social Research. He has taught college courses in philosophy and history of religion, gives private and public seminars and lectures, and has done over 300 radio and TV interviews. Neil is the author of Breaking the God Spell, a book which explores the ramifications of the archaeological, astronomical, and genetic proof for our being a genetically engineered part alien species. In his second book, God Games, What Do You Do Forever?, he outlines the species maturity of the new planetary civilization and describes the quote-unquote God games of immortality, four-dimensional consciousness, life after the law of everything, alien contact that the new human will play. His third book, Sapiens Rising, The View from 2100, explores the post-disclosure new human and new human planetary society as part of stellar society, already underway in this century, which will be known as our century of transformation. He has presented at the Arlington Institute, a Washington, D.C. futurist think tank. His most recent presentations, the Exopolitics Conference in Kona, Hawaii, and the E-SETI Conference at Trout Lake, Washington. Neil is scheduled to present at the Laughlin, Nevada International UFO Congress on February 10th, 2010. And directly from the state that started it all, for the flying saucer slash UFO genre. Well, other cases happened before 1947, but the most prominent one, directly from New Mexico, the author of many books, including one we'll be discussing tonight, Sapiens Rising, The View from 2100. Our special guest, Neil Freer. Hello, Mr. Freer, and welcome to the Veritas Show. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
It's my pleasure.
I've investigated your website pretty thoroughly, and I have to say, you know, I've probably done over 300 interviews since 1987 when I published Breaking the God Spell, and I have to admire the professionalism and the clarity of the materials.
Well, I thank you. It's an honor to hear those words coming from you, Mr. Freer. May I call you Neil?
Yes, please.
So that the audience knows, I recently had Bob Dean on the show, as you probably know, and he said live and offline to me Mel, you must have Neil Freer on your show. So thanks to Bob Dean for the recommendation and to Margaret Pierce, one of our volunteers who coordinated this interview indeed. Neil, please give us some background of yourself. And as I always ask, what brought you to this topic of flying saucers and extraterrestrial life? And also, you also describe yourself with the term coined by Dr. Timothy Leary, a futant, a future mutant. Please explain.
Well, let's take the futant term first. I've found myself very fortunate to have made good friends with him. I lived across the road from the back part of the Millbrook property where he had been given refuge by Billy Hitchcock of the Mellon family, and watched that situation for a year and realized that two things. One is that where there was that much smoke on the part of the local population, which was conservative, heavily Republican, and very wealthy in the Millbrook area, New York State, that there had to be some real fire. So I went over and introduced myself, became very good friends, watched the whole situation for a year, and actually did LSD there before it was even illegal, and was pure Sandoz acid, and found that it was more than it was even cracked up to be. And people say, well, you know, acid heads and all that kind of stuff. And Timothy was thrown out of Harvard and all that kind of stuff. But to go back, and we could talk about that because it's a fascinating thing, because Timothy was a futant himself, knows when to call one. And his experiences as a futant and as a, I think he was quite clearly the Tesla of psychology. But a futant, he defined as 1.5 to 2% of the population, futants at any given time, who are the DNA pops up like it pops up. Artists, philosophers, mechanics, whatever, for the sake of the survival of the species, a futant is 1.5 to 2% of the population at any given time who are programmed by the DNA to be the evolutionary scouts. It's relative to what we know by analogy of the beehive. You know, there's the queen bee and there's the workers and the young and the hive guardians with the big claws out there in front of the doorway. And there's the honey scouts. And they go out and find the honey, come back and do that little butt-waggling dance that says, this is where I found the honey and this is the direction to go and so on. And so futants who are programmed to do that come back and experience the future and come back and say to respectfully submitted, I was going to say, but Ursula, my wife, goes into a seething fit when I use that term.
I can tell why.
Yes, yes. So you come back and you put in front of everybody as much as you can your experience, and you say, you know, this is the way I think we should go in the evolutionary direction. And you hope for the best and hope that you're right. But that's what a futant is. And my background is I'm 79 going on 59. And the reason why we're probably talking today is that in 1936, I think I can pin it right at that particular year, as I recall, my parents and my sister and I were living in Poughkeepsie, New York. And we had relatives that lived in Gardner, New York, which is fascinating because Gardner is just above the area where Whitley Strieber went through a lot of this kind of stuff. And Gardner was a very rural community of only a few houses and a central general store and that kind of thing. And we were visiting over there, and it was a warm June evening. They didn't even have running water in the house at that particular point, and outside toilets and all that kind of thing. And so typically, the men folk, having finished dinner around 7 o'clock, left the women to do the dishes, in the kitchen, and went out and sat on the long front porch and started to do man talk. And, of course, at 6 years old at that particular point, I followed them out there to sit and listen and learn how to do man talk. And so very shortly after we got out there, around 7, this light came by in the sky, crossed from left to right, and somebody said, well, that must be the mail plane, because the mail planes were still, you know, small planes that were delivering bags of mail here and there. But then somebody said, well, I don't hear any noise. And so they kind of let it go, and only probably a minute or two after that, it got off to the left, to the right. Suddenly, I looked down the row of menfolk. My father was a Poughkeepsie, New York police officer. One of the other relatives was a state trooper. One was a carpenter. Two of them were carpenters. And everything stopped. It was totally, like, just stopped in mid-sentence, mid-word, mid-syllable. But I wasn't stopped. I was directed. This huge message was right there at 6 years old to walk around into the dark, scary. And I did what I was told or asked to do. And it was something big out there, but I never knew what it was. Then I found myself coming back onto the porch, and I looked down the row of men folks who were still totally immobilized and silent, frozen in time. Suddenly everything broke loose again, right in mid-sentence, and they continued to talk as if nothing had happened. And somebody looked at their watch, and they said, well, okay, what is this? It's 10:30, and it's time to go in. Well, we just got out here. And so, I had no idea of missing time experiences or anything of that. But looking back on it, it had all the characteristics of one of those typical abduction or contact situations.
Right.
And so that was that. I mentioned it to my father, and he looked at me as if he had no concept of what I was talking about. You know, and at six, I wasn't able to articulate it very well, but. Without taking too much time on this kind of thing, but this is probably very significant to, and would be significant to many listeners.
And back in those days, you didn't have the point of reference of Roswell or flying saucers, right?
Oh, no. And, of course, at 6 years old, I had no exposure to science fiction or
right.
any of that sort of thing. So I stored that. I was born and brought up Catholic, and I was going to a Catholic school with Dominican nuns and stuff. And then at 12 and a half, 13, someplace right in there, around 42, of course, this was 5 years before Roswell. I woke up in the middle of the night in this blue cloud field, and there were four of these little typical gray dudes holding me up horizontal, weightless, with these cheeky fingertips. They seemed to communicate with, and they were almost like apprentices. They were having fun doing this thing, and they seemed to be, you know, of an attitude that was almost my age, and it was pretty clear that they didn't want nothing was to frighten me at this particular point. And there was this, and they let me wake up in this blue cloud field, and they wanted me. It turned out that there was a sergeant, a little bit larger fella. More serious and obviously perhaps even more intelligent than the four little ones, at my head and back of me at my head. And he wanted to let me turn around and wanted me to ask, obviously, well, what is this all about? Because it was obviously not a dream. It was far too real. And when I looked around, and he wanted me to ask, well, what are you, or what's going on, what are you? And when I asked, what are you? He said very, very telepathically, very loud and clear, were androids. Well, in 1942, I had no idea what an android was, but he explained to me, and when he said it, he gave me to understand that it was a combination of a human and robot. That was the term.
A biorobot.
A biorobot, yeah. And yeah. But he was obviously very intelligent and much more intelligent than. My information content at that particular point. And so, and he made it clear that the group that he was representing, wanted me to represent them. He was asking politely, respectfully, and I was 12, if I would help them get reintroduced into the planet. It was so pleasant that, and so secure and so respectful that I, you know, and so intriguing and exciting, I said, well, sure. At that point, he put some huge bulk ball of information up through some subcortical context into my head and of information, and I thought, and I was an information junkie by that time, and I thought, wow, that's information. That's really great. But I can't understand it. And he said, you know, he told me telepathically, well, you won't understand it now. And it's meant for when you're much, much older. Maybe, you know, he gave me to believe something like 70s. And here I am.
How did they transfer the information? Did they use any device to transfer it?
No, there was no device at all that I was aware of. I mean, it was just as if he had it in his hand or in his mind or something, and was able to just directly transmit it right into my brain. That's the way it felt, and I recognize it as a pleasant experience, but very exciting. And at that point, he wanted me, I suppose, to ask, basically, who's your management? You know, if you're androids, you're robots. And
who's your leader?
Who's the leader? And he allowed me to, it was symbolic, but it was like he drew a curtain, and I looked behind the curtain, and there was this very human, husky, heavily bearded, gray and black beard fellow in a white robe, definitely not some metaphor for God or anything like that. It was an alien humanoid who communicated telepathically to me his real concern and appreciation of what I was doing, what I agreed to do. And they also gave me to believe, to understand that since I had agreed that they would watch out for me and take care of me, particularly physically, over the rest of my life. And it's been that way. I was a conscientious objector in the Korean War. I managed to convince the draft board that it wasn't, you know, it didn't meet the standards of a just war at all. And I got away with it. I was doing hospital work, and then I worked in a, somehow or other, lucked into a job as a librarian in a minimum security prison in New York State and stuff. So on and on. But that's the critical thing here is that that's where I got my start. Over time, I think one of the next real milestones was in 1976. By that time, having six kids to support, and I became a sheet metal contractor, having learned the trade in the union, and we were living in Woodstock, New York. And although I never read the local papers because they weren't really that informative, somehow or other, the Kingston Freeman was on my coffee table because we did get the newspaper. I was almost compelled to pick it up, and I picked it up, and the first thing I read was an article mentioning a book that was about to come out by this fellow, Zechariah Sitchin. And I read the blurb that it was about our history as a genetically engineered species. And I thought to myself, and the word, and when I saw the word Anunnaki, it rang a bell, because when I told my parents about this situation way back in 42, my mother, my parents are looking at me like, oh my God, what do we have on our hands here? And my mother said, well, what would they call? And I said, well, the word was something like Anunnaki or something very close to that. And she just stored that, and she said, well, what's an android?
Huh.
And that, because that word was not used in science fiction until, I think I looked it up sometime until at least 1948 or afterwards, although the word android is in the dictionary as a French word derivative. And she had no idea, and when I explained it to her, that it was just more mystifying and maybe scary to her. At any rate, when I saw that word Anunnaki in that pre-publication, well, it was sort of a review in the Kingston Freeman in 76, I thought, uh-oh, here we go. So I picked up on Sitchin's work, I got to know him, and I've worked with his material critically and scholarly since 1976, and when, in 87 I wrote Breaking the Godspell, which worked out the ramifications of, you know, the significance and information that was there in his work, the focal point being that the great religions, as we know them, the deity-worshipping fear of deity or religions, are simply historical and psychological sublimations of the ancient master-slave relationship that we were created under 200,000 years ago by them as a hybrid species, you know, Homo erectus, with their Anunnaki genes, alien genes, impinged on them to create a race of subservient creatures that would mine gold for them, take their place in their gold mines. And by the way, you may probably know by now that we have rediscovered gold mines in South Africa where they started mining gold that are dated at 100,000 years old. So that's the kind of background. Subsequently, I have a degree in English. I went back at 35 to pick up a PhD in philosophy in the New School for Social Research and dropped out after the master's degree level, simply because there was no room for creative thought. And I also knew practically that by that time that a father of six was not going to be able to make the kind of money that was necessary as a philosophy professor.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And after you get your, let's call it, download of information in 1942, how did your life change among your friends, among your family? Did they notice a difference in your intellect and the way you behaved around them?
It was interesting. My father, for instance, take him one at a time here. My father absorbed all this information, and what was probably very significant, and which I didn't mention before, and that is about 3 months after this enlistment experience, I went to bed again, same place, same room, and there was a street light out diagonally opposite the house at an intersection. And it was probably 9 o'clock at night. I had just gotten in bed, and the light outside started to get brighter and brighter and brighter. And so I opened the green blocking shade, and I realized that it wasn't just a street light. It was something really going on out there. So my mother and father were still awake, and they were in the kitchen having a cup of coffee or something, and I went out there and I got them. And my father came, and it was cold, December, I think. And so he was so intrigued by this gradually brighter and brighter light outside. Nobody else seemed to be noticing it in the neighborhood. He took the old top-hung wooden frame storm window off of the hinges and took it inside the living room, and he's sitting on the windowsill, the second story, outside, sitting on the windowsill, looking up at this light. I get on the windowsill alongside of him, and I'm looking up at the light, and right above the house, probably only 200 feet above, there is, in the bright light, there's a ship. And I said to him, "Oh, that must be the little guys." And he's looking at me like, "Oh my God, what have I got in my hands here?"
Crazy boy.
And then the thing shot off, totally silent. It was silent all through this, but it was it shot off into space, going into warp drive, right. We see pictures and videotapes of flying saucers do that all the time. And but this was still 42, and he told me maybe a year or so after this, after he's thought about it and thought about it and thought about it, they came back, and it was very, very considerate. They came back and they reassured the parents, who had no clues, that, the kid wasn't really going bonkers. And he told me afterwards that as a police officer, about 4 o'clock in the morning, motorcycle, deserted streets in the city, he was riding eastward on a main drag, and this huge green something or other came over, silent, over the top of his head, and he didn't know whether the hiccup or turned blue, quite honestly. He called the station, and they said, "Well, nobody else is reporting anything like that." And he called Vassar College, which is right on the edge of Poughkeepsie. He called the astronomical department and asked them if they had seen anything. No, nothing. And so he just stored that one. But, I think it was probably kind of priming him up. So the reaction on part of my father was always probably summed up very well when he said to me one time, "You could fall on a latrine and come up covered with gold." I don't know exactly what this is all about, but he admitted that there was something really to it. My mother was a little bit different. She had no reference points. She was a good Catholic, and so was he, for that matter. Between the parents, there was a bit of difference. And friends, I just made sure that I didn't talk to many people about it at all, because I knew from a couple of trial runs that I didn't need my friends thinking that I was totally loopy. At that particular point, of course, the government in 5 years, and by the time of 47, things began to change. But I still, over time, I have always kind of kept a lot of that to myself, just for practical purposes, as you can well understand.
Well, your upbringing sounds more or less like mine. Conservative Catholic family, Catholic school. I'm surprised they didn't tell you to go get an exorcism.
Well, they really didn't have to, because by the time I was 18 and graduated from high school, I was fortunate enough to get a full tuition scholarship to RPI, which is a good engineering college. I went there for a year, realized that that was not my thing. It was a trade school. And so I realized that the best thing I could do to explore the universe and God and all that kind of stuff was to become a priest. So I went to the Black Franciscans. I studied with them for a year or two. And I went from there under the influence of Thomas Merton to Trappist Monastery in Rhode Island, Massachusetts. And Massachusetts, where the first one burned down. And I was there 6 months as a Trappist novice, and they sent me away. The novice master had tears in his eyes, and he said, we don't know what you're about, but you don't belong in a monastery. And Hindsight said he did me a big favor.
Right.
I asked him, and you can probably appreciate this one as a Catholic or former Catholic. I said, well, would you give me a recommendation to the Carthusians?
from Romo Seminary to having six children, now that's a big contrast there.
Well, when I came out, they sent me away, and when I came out, I was picked up by the Sulpicians and supported, financed by the Bishop of Washington.
Right.
And in the Sulpician Seminary in Baltimore, and I studied philosophy there for 2 years, and then I realized, this is not it. And I left and eventually came out, got married, six kids, still doing the Catholic trip. I managed to get through the conscientious objector part of my life, still intact and not in jail. And and then I found myself living in Millbrook across the back fence from Tim Leary's place.
Right.
That was a very significant experience. It's probably worth mentioning, too, you know, that Tim has a variety of perspectives on him as far as the public is concerned and the way he's been presented by the establishment and academia. But the real reason, and I felt it was necessary to bring this up when I spoke at the Arlington Institute think tank to the audience, had some Pentagon brass and stuff in it, people in it. And the reason why Tim was put out of Harvard was not because of his promulgation of LSD, but because of money and politics. People don't realize that at that particular time in this early 60s, he, with graduate students, were running on state-funded grants, state of Massachusetts.
Sure.
They were running LSD sessions in for the toughest prisoners in the toughest prisons in the state of Massachusetts. And they were getting all kinds of good reviews and accolades and encouragement from the psychologists and the rehabilitation people in the prison systems, because they were getting 85% of these toughest criminals with one or two sessions seeing through their life and on their own changing their behavior and coming out on parole and staying out, 85%. Whereas previously, the recidivism, where they would go right back in, was 85%. And so they were accomplishing tremendous stuff. Tim went into the office of the prison warden, whom he knew well, and the warden said, Tim, before you give me your monthly report there, come over and take a look at this. And he showed him this huge architectural scale model of in the corner of his office of buildings that he was going to be building. Big feather in his cap, maybe more money, maybe a little promotion, who knows. But at any rate, Timothy told me himself, he said, you know, it was the stupidest thing I think I ever did in my whole life. I said to him offhandedly, well, if we keep going the way we're going, you won't need these. And he said, within a split second, I realized, you know, I saw the shades come down in his eyes, and I realized I just cut my own throat. And sure enough, within 6 months, the warden, who had previously been giving him all kinds of recommendations and praise and stuff, was bad-mouthing him to the press. And so I think it's significant that the way futons are often have been treated. It's like whether it be Galileo or Giordano Bruno, who was almost contemporary, basically contemporary with a Galileo,
right.
Who was a monk, and who insisted on saying that he thought it was very possible. This was about around 1600. Actually, this was 36 years before Harvard University was founded as a divinity school. And he said, you know, there's got to be other planets like this, other worlds with other people in this huge, huge universe. And so they barbecued his ass and at the stake in Rome. And they don't do that, I guess, anymore that I know of, because they probably couldn't get away with it. And so I take it, stretch Futin all now into the future, and we see that I think it's, I'm totally confident in saying that we eventually will recognize Futins as contributory. We will systematically tap them and evaluate, going to say that we're going to take them as, hopefully, we're not going to take them as some kind of absolute authority or word, but we're going to take advantage of what Futins can contribute. And that,
with what happened to Giordano Bruno.
Sure.
So much for thou shalt not kill, right? But Neil, I have, that's a great background, but I want to start the show with a more generalized approach, and then I want to really delve into the new book, 2012, the Anunnaki, the Sumerian tablets. So let's start with the generalized aspect of the show. You mentioned the possibility of life outside of this planet, and I've always been fascinated by the Drake equation. It compels me to say, without the shadow of a doubt, judging by the billions of stars in the universe, that it would be the height of arrogance to say we're alone. That said, what's it going to take before we can join the quote-unquote galactic neighborhood, Neil?
I think I can express it in the fewest words by simply quoting, almost, or stating this, the same basic premise platform from which I start in Sapiens Rising, The View from 2100. It is obvious at this particular point, even though official acknowledgement, and I think we should use the word acknowledgement rather than disclosure, because disclosure is basically already on the road. Brazil, Spain, France, Belgium, England, India, many of them already releasing the information of classified documents and all that kind of stuff. It's almost as if everybody knows, but official disclosure by the United States hasn't come. C.B. Scott Jones, my associate and former intelligence, career intelligence, says that he was told when he was sent by Senator Pell around the world to gather a lot of information about both this topic and the paranormal, that the Chinese told him, whenever the United States gets around to doing official disclosure, we'll be right behind. But the basic premise is that we're being invited into stellar society. We're being given the opportunity, but we've also been given the rules. It's pretty clear. You don't take weapons in space, fellas, and you go as a united, peaceful species, not particular nation or even cultural context or civilization. This is beyond civilization. It has to be as a united, peaceful species. So to meet those conditions, we are not going to have to do the one half of major acknowledgement disclosure about the fact that we, well, okay, they're here and we're trying to learn about them and we maybe see the rules. But the other half of disclosure, full disclosure, will have to be the acknowledgement and recognition and restoration of our actual part alien nature, because our history, which is now available to us in volumes from the recovered information over the last 150 years from the ancient civilizations, abetted and reinforced by our gradual scientific knowledge that allows us to understand how those seemingly magical or scientifically impossible things that were attributed to the quote-unquote gods could happen. Now we have atomic bombs, and we can particle beam weapons and lasers and that sort of stuff. And so once we do this, then we can go the next step and gradually, hopefully speedily, acknowledge that religions, which are the major obstacles to us becoming a united, peaceful species, the my God is better than your God syndrome is what causes us to be at each other's throat and slaughtering each other.
But Neil, you mentioned China. China saying United States will be behind you if you disclose. Why in the world should another country wait for us to disclose? Why can't they just come out and say it? If what we're doing here, by keeping technology that may prevent us from dying in a plane crash, technology that's going to be preventing and curing disease, why can't a country say, enough, that's a crime against humanity, that's a crime against the planet, we will disclose? Why not, Neil?
I can only guess. I don't know whether it is because China feels that we have more technological information or whether we have the technology that we're not disclosing, and we could ultimately threaten and put pressure on China to just keep quiet until we say, or whether it's the Chinese thousands of years of political savvy that say strategically,
patience.
Let them make fools of themselves first, before we come out with what we have knowledge of. And because the Chinese, and the Japanese too, for that matter, there's this whole tradition in Japan that focuses around on the what they are called the Takanuchi documents. You probably are aware of. They're documents on papyrus or paper or on metal and other types of material. The text is so old, the writing is so old, that apparently it is almost undecipherable except by people who are skilled in the most ancient Hebrew. And these, for 2,500 years, these documents have been preserved as the treasury of the Japanese emperor, the emperor's family, and they've been preserved by the highest Shinto priest family. Some of them have actually lost their lives protecting and defending these things. And they say, yeah, aliens landed here. They even show pictures of Great Circle navigational maps, some of light plans and stuff, some of which go to the Middle East. And so we've got all this material in the East. So, again, I have to say I'm only guessing, but I would think that it would be a combination of political, maybe even economic. We have, in one sense, from one perspective, we have the Chinese in a headlock because they have bought so much of our debt. But then on the other hand, from their perspective, they feel that they can control us, the United States, to a certain degree, and because of the fact that we owe them so much. So
right.
I'm thinking out loud here, and I'm taking a lot of time to say basically that I'm not really sure.
That's okay. Won't the quote-unquote powers that be, particularly religious and political entities, oppose any move toward what you call quote-unquote genetic enlightenment of the general population? Do we just wait for the old guard to die out as we educate the new generations, or perhaps this eventual awakening is inevitably that cannot be entirely prevented? It reminds me of Max Planck's quote, "A new scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponent and making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die." Isn't this what's going to take? How many generations are we going to have to go through before true enlightenment comes along?
I like to think of it in terms of two, a principle and a metaphor. The principle I call the ice principle, I period, C period, E period, which is a combination of a quotient, which is the intelligence, consciousness, and evolutionary quotient put together, ICE, in the same sense that we currently use just the intelligence quotient, of an individual or a group. And the metaphor is a bell curve. When you're looking at the Liberty Bell, that profile is called a bell curve, and the majority of the population is in the middle, on the highest part of the middle of the bell curve. The futans tend to hang out way up in the front leading edge, and there are always some of the population, for whatever reason, that are on the back flange of that curve. But it's also dynamic, and it's almost like an inchworm crawling up the stem of a leaf or something. It pulls up its backside until it touches the front, and then it straightens out and then pulls it up and goes along. And so if we look at it on that particular point, from that particular kind of metaphor and view, I think that we can see that the intelligence, consciousness, and evolutionary quotients are exponentially increasing, exponentially in the sense of it's not like 1, 2, 3, 4, it's like squared, so on. It's rapid from one point of view. and it's increasing more rapidly all the time. But 60 years of this kind of thing, from my personal point of view, makes me feel like we're living in the 12th century. It also feels, frankly, quite boring. I think that you can see that it kind of runs in 50-year periodicities, maybe even 100-year periodicity, so that when I say, okay, Sapiens Rising, the view from 2100, it's a bit arrogant, I suppose, the view from 2100 AD, but that's only 100 years from now. And I think when we get there, we will see that this century will be our century of major species transformation. People say, well, you know, we'll wipe ourselves out with pollution and war and everything else before we ever get there. But I tend to disagree. I think that when you see the general population now ready and almost impatient through Gene Roddenberry's Star Trek and all those beautiful kind of programs. By the way, just as an aside, you know that Tim Leary and Gene Roddenberry share a spacecraft, a satellite that has 7 ounces of each one of their ashes in it together?
I did not know about Tim Leary.
The idea here is that I'm totally positive about this. Yes, it will take a major transformation of the Vatican and the Roman Catholic Empire and the evangelical Christians and the fundamentalists and people say, well, the evangelicals are not the same as the Vatican. Well, you know, when you look back in history, first of all, it's clear from the scholarship that the New Testament and the Old Testament, both of which are theopolitically skewed documents, the biggest handicap that the evangelicals and the whistleblowers, the protesters, the Protestants took with them was they took, you know, they took the New Testament and the Old Testament with them. And perfectly good faith, not to make a bad pun, but they, you know, it's been a handicap all this time because the transformation of the religions is going to be very difficult, although there are those within those religions that are cognizant of this, of the need. But the powers that be, hopefully this time we won't have to wait for all the old guard to die off, according to that thesis. I think that we also have to recognize that almost literally the old guard that started this cover-up on a political and military basis, separate from the religions, although probably in cahoots with them, they're probably mostly dead. And any of those who still remain, I think, should be simply granted amnesty. I think that Stanton Friedman, you know, said it very well years ago when he said, you know, when you look at it in a historical perspective, in 1947, that far back, they get a crash saucer, and they don't know what to make of it. And they didn't have enough information, so they said, well, we better cover this up. And that was probably a good idea at that particular point. Then they had the Brookings Institute do a study, and the Brookings Institute said, well, yeah, if you just go blast this out there and reveal it, it's going to totally disrupt the religions and the general...
And science.
General public may panic and so on. And maybe that was a good idea at that particular point. But it's an albatross around the neck of those sincere, at least white hats, that are within the intelligence and governmental agencies in the United States, because they don't know whether to just go ahead and reveal or to ask for amnesty or try to explain themselves and stuff. And then, of course, we have the black hats, who are both directly in the military and the intelligence, and also in the military-industrial complex, you know, that Eisenhower warned us about, who, for very specific economic and political and personal reasons, like income and all that sort of thing, will, you know, they'll hurt you.
And I want to talk about amnesty in a few minutes.
Sure.
Because I think that's very important. I discussed that in detail with, you probably know who Jim Sparks is.
Oh, yes. Yes.
But there's one side of ufology, of the ufology camp, Neil, that says all ETs are benevolent, and another one that disagrees. This is a major disagreement in ufology. Where do you stand with this?
Well, I can best talk from the point of view of being an advisory board member of the exopolitics.org Institute. I see within the ufology community, investigators, contactees, and so on, this as a major consideration. And I think that probably both sides of the discussion, I won't even call it a disagreement, the discussion is highly influenced by each individual's personal ICE principle.
Right.
And also, because I've pushed on a lot of investigators, as respectfully as I could, to let's get past this kind of backing into the thing, quibbling among ourselves as to whether this particular contactee was for real or hallucinating, whether this one was giving us accurate information, whether this one was government, is a government covert operational person, and so on, so on, so on. That's because exopolitics, you know, if we look at it as the consideration of the interaction between the human species and other alien species, first of all, we're handicapped by not knowing who we are and in denial, or at least having it suppressed by those who don't want it known, whether it be religionists or politicians or intelligence people or whomever. We're handicapped by the fact that we don't know who we are, or at least we don't, some of us know who we are, but other ones, you know, there's people out there who are following the classic line of, well, we're a flawed species affected by original sin, and we left to ourselves and not totally supervised by some cosmic God, we're going to do ourselves tremendous harm and other people, and we could destroy ourselves and probably end up in hell. And then, on the other hand, we have the people who say, well, we're actually, it's not that way at all. We're evolutionarily motivated, and we're an evolving species. Maybe we're young and still a little bit primitive, but, you know, we're positive and so on. And what it really comes down to is that we're highly influenced by this argument, this classic disagreement and argument among ourselves between the evolutionist and the creationist. And what I'm pointing out in Sapiens Rising, the best I can, is that there is a complete third paradigm that subsumes, corrects, and supersedes that particular discussion. Because if Zechariah Sitchin is correct in his work, and I think after all these years of working with it critically, I can say, yes, I believe he is right on, and we are a part alien species, and religion as such that gave rise to the creationist thing is the sublimation, continuation of the ancient master-slave relationship, and that two of those Anunnaki, one was Enki and one was Enlil, the two brothers that were basically in charge of their colonization of this planet. One was, Enki was Adonai the Lord, Enlil was Jehovah Yahweh, and those two were fused in Genesis and in the Old Testament by the Levite priest, who knew very well that they were plural, by the fact that they used for their supposedly single monotheistic God. Because,
and Neil, yes. I don't mean to interrupt you. I want to get there in a second. I don't want to be jumping too ahead. But let me just, if I could, I really like the prologue of your book, some words from Buckminster Fuller. The present evolutionary crisis of humans on planet, and this is, by the way, because we're talking about how primitive we are. The present evolutionary crisis of humans on planet Earth is that of a final examination for their continuance universe. It is not an examination of political, economic, or religious systems, but of the integrity of each and all individual humans responsible, thinking and unselfish response to the acceleration in evolution's ever more unprecedented events. So then the question, how primitive are we then?
Ah. I take us in the best cosmic perspective that I can at this particular point as a bit of both. We're a young, adolescent, developing species, and you can look on our genetic creation and hybrid nature, part of which, you know, our Homo erectus component makes us in tune with the Earth, and in a sense, we are very primitive in that particular phase of our nature. and just discovering, the cosmos. But on the other hand, the Anunnaki component makes us, in 200,000 years of our existence, we have gone from square one as a slave species, mining gold and running around naked as slaves to the Anunnaki, to, going to Mars shortly with whomever can afford to go with us. This does not match the sequence of so-called normal evolution, where it took Homo erectus in itself as a species to go from rough flake stone tools to smooth flake stone tools in a million years. In 200,000 years, we've come a long, long way, baby, in that sense. So we're primitive relative to the other advanced species that we have made contact with, but more adolescent rather than just very childlike. Best I can do.
No, that's good. That's good. Now, we talk about exopolitics, the coined term by our mutual friend Alfred Weber.
Yes.
And you have good people like Dr. Michael Sala and so on. But there's a word that you use also, exosociology. Can you define and describe what exosociology is all about?
Yes. In lectures, I've used a slide that says, oh, look, exopolitics is a great start. But an exo means off-planet.
Right.
Cosmic, that sort of thing. And so I said, it's inevitable that eventually, hopefully sooner than later, we will be offering academic courses at maybe at the graduate level first, and then in the undergraduate level, and then high school, and then grade school, in practical exosociology, where we study systematically study the sociological conditions and cultures and so on of alien species, but we'll also be studying exopsychology and the psychology of other alien species. We took Gene Roddenberry took a really great crack at it, and so did Spielberg. That classic scene in the cafeteria, so to speak, where there was a whole bunches of alien different species. I don't know, they were drinking whatever that species drank.
You mean Star Wars?
In Star Wars, yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and
the cantina.
Yeah, and then we do a lot of... Science fiction is really valuable because we do a lot of projection into the future. I remember at 6 or 8, 10 years old, I couldn't wait for the comic strips to come in the Sunday paper so I could read Buck Rogers.
Right.
And then in the 60s, beginning in 66, I remember I really appreciated the fact that my kids could be watching Star Trek. And, of course, where do we go there? I mean, talk about our own psychology. The first thing was Captain Kirk wrestling some lizard creature, other alien species in one of the shows. And we had the ostensibly hard-drinking Scottish engineer and Dr. Spock with a different physical characteristics and so on, and very rational. And then we went from there, eventually through changes in the psychology and the presentations and so on, and we end up with Picard, the Earl Grey tea drinking, Shakespeare quoting gent.
Yes.
And
yes.
Then a woman captain and a black captain. And
right.
And we went from technologies to technologies to technologies. And the fascinating part of it for me was where we went out to the extreme of the Borg, who were practically androids, but humanoid, and then the other extreme to the warlike Klingons. And so we kind of exhausted the parameters at that particular point. And I've always appreciated it as good preliminary science fiction, certainly, but exopsychology and exosociology. And we will have exomedicine. Just about any topic that we study in the schools now, we will begin sooner or later, hopefully sooner, to study those things about alien societies on a systematic basis and exoscience. And I think that we have a lot of exoscience that we've picked up that is being suppressed, and that's very unfortunate because free energy, combination, as I said in the last part of Sapiens, I think it's clear already that we have three technologies that will take us past the primitive, definitely primitive, competitive nature of our social interactions and economies at this particular point. If we put together free energy, where the energy source will be either a tiny thing that will run your wristwatch or your house or manufacturing plant without any grid or anything of the sort, combine that with nanotechnology, which will, the end product and result of nanotechnology is that at the molecular chemical level, we can transform anything into anything. Recycling is an integral part of that. And so we will end up with getting past the illusion of having to compete for limited resources because we will continually recycle whatever we're working with. And
I'm so glad that you're saying that because we have to take a break, Neil.
Yes. But
I want to continue talking about the paradigms we live in. Immortality, that's something I want to talk when we come back. Before we take a break, let me ask you a question. I'll get your answer on the other side, and then I'd like you to tell the audience how to get in touch with your work.
Sure.
Folks, we're going to get into so much more. 2012, the Anunnaki, immortality, so much. I heard, Neil, you mentioned that NASA astronomers have found the 10th planet in our solar system and are so sure about it that the only thing left is to name it. Also, somebody a few days ago sent me a picture of what was on Google Space, I believe, with the coordinates. A few days later, that person tried to go back to the coordinates and Google had removed that area of the space map. So how do we get in touch with your work?
My website is www.neilfreer.com. The third book that we're kind of referencing here is not mentioned on there, although the name of my website is Sapiens Rising. The third book I purposely published on Kindle format. Kindle is the new electronic reader that Amazon has put out, which is a sweet machine. You know, it will hold, in its basic form, will hold 100 books, and you can download the books, you know, in a minute and a half and so on, at a reduced price usually. And there's no trees falling for the paper, you know, to publish that way. And that's, so Kindle, Amazon.com, Kindle, the third book, Sapiens Rising, is available there. My email and is neil@neilfreer.com. Glad to hear from anybody. And I guess that should cover it.
And I'll put a link on our website as well. Folks, what a fascinating show. And you have no idea what's coming. It's a lot of stuff. So please stay tuned. This is Mel Fabregas. You're listening to The Veritas Show. We're here with Neil Freer. Don't go anywhere. Thank you very much for listening. We're going to talk more with our special guest in our members section. Head on over to our website, veritasshow.com, click on subscribe, and join us in the members area to tune in to the second part of this great show. We'll take a short break, listen to some music, and we'll be right back with more.
Hey, hey. This is Stan Romanek, and you're listening to The Veritas Show.